Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, December 8th. This is our weekly news roundup, and we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodTimes.com is Jeff Spillane. Good morning, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll hear from Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Andy Tomolonis of South Coast Today, and Wood at the Provincetown Banner, and George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Let's begin now, Jeff, with an announcement this week, a very quiet kind of end for what was one of the louder debates and controversies the region has seen. Cape Wind announced that it was giving up its proposal to build 130 wind turbines in Nantucket Sound. It's not wholly surprising, but it is the end of an era.
It certainly is, Steve. This is the end of a 16-year saga that came to a close last Friday in a bit of a surprise. The Cape Wind notified the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management in Washington that it would be terminating its offshore wind development lease. For those that aren't familiar with Cape Wind, I can't imagine you aren't living here or listening in with us. There was a plan at one point to build 130 wind turbines in Nantucket Sound, right in the middle of the sound. A lot of people say that this Cape Wind project really had its death knell about 2 years ago, when Eversource and National Grid canceled their contracts to buy the power. So over the course of the past 2 years, Cape Wind has still been paying almost $90,000 per year to maintain this lease for 46 miles of federal waters in Nantucket Sound.
So this happened kind of quietly. They sent out an email on Friday, and even some of the big players in this story didn't hear about it until you started. I know they started calling them and looking for a reaction.
That's right. It was very quiet. It came through an email. It was a very brief statement talking about termination of the lease. And I was one of many reporters that was on this story on Friday and calling some of the players that have been involved in this 16-year contentious issue. Almost didn't believe that it was happening. Especially some of the opponents, the Alliance to Protect Nantucket Sound, the town of Barnstable, the Barnstable Municipal Airport. And their initial concern was, is this just a case of them selling the lease to the federal waters on Nantucket Sound? Turns out it wasn't. But there was a little bit of skepticism there for a while.
Now, the article says they spent $100 million on this project over the 16 years they were trying to make this happen.
They have.
$100 million.
And it's not going to happen. And James Gordon, who is the president of the company that was operating the Cape Wind project, said a lot of what the money was spent on, of course, was lawsuits. There was a lot of legal activity over the course of the past 16 years. And he said, if there's one bright side, there really have been some legal precedents that have set to make it easier for additional offshore wind projects in the future.
I know that wind advocates were suggesting that this long, drawn-out process, which really was one of the first in the nation to try to permit offshore wind, has really set the table for this next round of offshore wind that's being developed much differently south of the Vineyard.
That's right. It has. And, of course, there's the project off of Block Island, and now we're talking about Vineyard Sound, which is, as you mentioned, southwest of Martha's Vineyard, in a much different area than what would be in the middle of Nantucket Sound.
Cape Wind still has some equipment out there in Nantucket Sound.
There's a meteorological tower that still stands out there. It was erected in 2003, so they will be responsible for the cost of removing that.
And what else do we know here as we're going forward on this?
This is the end from all we can tell. It's done.
Yeah, it's almost hard to believe it after
is.
So much back
it
and
is.
Forth.
That's right.
We had a sad story this week about a fishing boat out of New Bedford that sank off Nantucket. Two crew members were rescued, but two went missing. What do we know about this?
Yeah, this was a horrible tragedy, Steve. This happened Monday afternoon, about 10 miles off Nantucket. The Misty Blue, which is a 69-foot fishing boat out of New Bedford, was on the Nantucket Shoals. It was doing some surf clam harvesting, and the boat sank. It tipped over. Two members, from what we understand, had their survival suits on at the time. Two others were in the process of putting it on when the boat turned and went underwater. As of right now, there are still two of the crew members are missing, and the search has been called off at this point. And the Massachusetts State Police dive team in the area, using side sonar, thinks they may have detected the boat about 80 to 90 feet underwater. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to get out there as soon as they can, but weather conditions are preventing that right now. And the two other crew members were safely rescued by another fishing boat in the area and taken to New Bedford, and they are safe and sound.
Mm. And some of the reporting detailing the from the family members of the missing sailors, mm-hmm. the crew members, and what a difficult moment it is.
Certainly, yeah. And we spoke with some of the family members in New Bedford, but you know, this is such a difficult job and such a dangerous job, as I've learned over the years.
Well, a report came out then in the day after the sinking that a crew member of the Misty Blue had sued the owner over conditions on the boat, and this was earlier in the year.
Yeah, it was actually a month before the tragic accident last week. A former crew member filed a lawsuit in Boston claiming negligence on behalf of the captain and crew of the Misty Blue. This worker was seriously injured in an accident in September, coming out of the fish hold of the boat. Some of the area around the fish hold collapsed, and he suffered a major injury, smashing his heel.
That his foot went through the deck,
Doesn't sound good. And in the lawsuit that's been filed, they talk about the term unseaworthy. And it's a bit of a, it's interesting here, because the attorney in this case said, unseaworthy, don't think that really would refer to the vessel as not being safe to go out and conduct its work and fish. But if there's anything, any unsafe condition on a vessel, that would be considered unseaworthy. So that is moving forward in court as well. But they're claiming, the owners of the vessel, that everything was up to date and the boat was in great shape.
So the fact that the lawsuit deemed was contending that the boat was unseaworthy, it turns out that's kind of a legal phrase.
It
doesn't really mean that there was
a maritime legal phrase.
Mm-hmm. And that the boat actually had been inspected.
It had.
Relatively recently.
That's right.
We are going to go right now to Sarah Brown of the Vineyard Gazette, who joins us. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
Sarah, you have a story about a proposal to expand Edgartown's oyster industry that's led to plenty of discussion and sounds like some soul-searching on this.
Absolutely, yeah. Really interesting discussion, as you said, about oyster farming in town. And this was spurred by an application by a young Edgartown resident, Noah Skeffer, and he comes from a family of fishermen and oyster farmers. And he applied for a one-acre lease to run an oyster farm in South Cape Pogue Pond over on Chappaquiddick. And he said he really wants to make a living here on the island. He and his wife are about to, or maybe have actually just had a baby. And he said this would allow him to live here and make a living on the water. And so this is a long process to get a new oyster lease. It goes before the Shellfish Committee, then to town selectmen, then the state comes down. So this is by no means going to be a quick process, but it did start with the Shellfish Committee. And so instead of just looking at this one application of NOAA's, they kind of expanded it and said, okay, what would it look like if we opened up Cape Pogue for 8 oyster farmers over 10 acres?
Sarah, can you describe Cape Pogue a little bit for us, for folks who aren't familiar, why people consider this a very special location?
Absolutely, yeah. So Cape Pogue, as I said, it's over on Chappaquiddick, and when you look at Chappaquiddick, there's kind of this long arm going up, and there's a pond that's open to the water, and it's really large, and that's Cape Pogue Pond. I mean, it's really pristine, really, people describe it as really the last untouched, pristine, underdeveloped place on the island. There's not a lot of houses around it. It's a really unique coastal abatement and really prized by scallopers and conch fishermen who fish in that area. So yeah, it's really special to a lot of people for a lot of different uses. And so that was really the tension here, as you said, was between wanting to expand the oyster industry and also wanting people who want to protect this kind of, what they said, this last pristine spot, a really unique and special spot on the island. And, you know, to put it in context, too, the oyster farming industry is really thriving in Edgartown. The town was really a pioneer in the effort to begin aquaculture about 20 years ago. and there are about 12 really thriving oyster farms in Katama Bay over in, so not on Chappie, but in Katama Bay, and it's the fourth most productive oyster-growing area in the state. But it's limited to 12 farms, and they're maxed out, and there's a waiting list. So really, Noah Skeffer's application was saying he wants to get in on this industry. There are probably others, too, and he wanted to find a place to do it, so he suggested Cape Pogue. But the in the end, really, the location was what people couldn't come to agree with here. There's concerns from the harbor master about navigation, commercial scallopers and conch fishermen who said they use that area. And, you know, one fisherman said it felt like they would essentially be taking this area from him and giving it to the oyster farmer. So a little bit of tension between commercial fishing and this new aquaculture industry. And initially, the Shellfish Committee seemed inclined to support this. They said they support aquaculture, should be allowed to go to a hearing. And they talked a lot about, you know, we need jobs for year-round islanders on the island. So this is a way to do that. Mm-hmm. But this week, after hearing more concerns about the location, they said, okay, we support aquaculture, but they didn't feel they could support this proposal. And they voted not to support it, though I should add, Noah Skeffer can still bring it straight to selectmen, so it's not necessarily completely done. But the real end result was opening up a larger discussion about the future of aquaculture on the island. And so they've decided, the Shellfish Committee has decided to move forward with a comprehensive review of town waters in Edgartown to see, okay, if we want to expand aquaculture, where would it be best to do that? If not Cape Pogue, where? Mm-hmm. So they're going to work with other town committees, take a more holistic approach because, you know, as they said this week, this isn't going away. They do want to support people who want to make a living here and who want to follow in the tradition of making a living off the water. So if Cape Pogue's off the table, at least for now, where else are they going to do it? So that's kind of the conversation this opened up.
And a lot of it coming out of the fact that oyster farming has been so successful that it really is a success story on the island.
Absolutely, yeah. And that was really what, you know, Noah Skeffer was saying is that he sees this as a great industry. And there are a lot of benefits that other people mentioned, which have been shown over the last couple decades, that, you know, it's good for the water. It's a more sustainable fishery. And there's a high demand, and even some oyster farmers said they welcome having more oyster farmers. There's not going to hurt their business. So yeah, it is really thriving and really successful. So I think what people ended up saying is that we need to. This is the way of the future. So they were advocating a more deliberate approach to where they're going to be expanding it. So I think that will be the next step for discussion here.
Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette. Thank you, Sarah, for that.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Jeff Spillane. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Jeff Spillane. And with us on the phone right now from the Cape Cod Chronicle is Tim Wood. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, Chatham is taking aim at the housing crunch with a bylaw allowing apartments and single-family homes. Or they're looking at this. Tell us about this.
Yeah, like most Cape towns, Chatham has, you know, housing problems. The average value of a single-family home here is over $800,000. That really puts it out of the range of most young people, families, even a lot of working professionals. And there aren't a lot of apartments in town either. And the ones that are pretty pricey with, you know, rents can range from $1,000 to $2,000 a month. So this spring, the planning board here in town hopes to pass a zoning bylaw that they hope will ease this crunch a little bit. It's based on a model bylaw developed by the Cape Cod Commission, and the measure allows single-family homeowners to create separate apartments in their homes. It's called an accessory dwelling unit bylaw. And the proponents say that it would help bring down rents by creating more units, essentially a supply and demand issue. But it's not really designed to create affordable housing with a capital A. Chatham, like other towns, already has a bylaw that allows the creation of affordable apartments in single-family homes. But these come with restrictions. You know, you have to rent to specific people on a specific list, and the rental amounts are controlled. And all those restrictions have resulted in basically the creation of zero units under that bylaw. So what town officials are hoping is that by really removing a lot of those restrictions, they'll help engender some new apartments. Now, under this bylaw, all other zoning and health regulations, such as the number of bedrooms allowed on a parcel, would still apply. So the measure, they say, wouldn't increase density. It would, however, have a benefit of allowing, say, older homeowners to create an apartment out of unused rooms in their house, spare rooms, be able to gain some extra income. The apartments could also be rented. They could basically be rented to anyone. So it could be a caretaker for the homeowner, or it could be, a family in, say, a two-bedroom unit, or an older resident who just wants a separate apartment and, be able to share the space with someone. There would also be controls included to prevent these units from being used as summer rentals, which is another concern people have.
Mm-hmm.
Would they be rented for astronomical sums during the summer and just go empty the rest of the year? So there are controls that would deal with that. Now, at this point, the Planning Board is reviewing the language of the model bylaw. They're going to be doing that at their December 12th meeting, and they're going to talk about changes to make it sort of more compatible with Chatham. And they plan to have language ready to have public hearings over the winter and preparation for bringing it to town meeting in May.
Hmm. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for that story.
Thank you, Steve.
Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times. Jeff, a scientific study into drinking water and health risks from a class of chemicals is being launched, with much of the research expected to be conducted here on the Cape.
It is. And Steve, over the course of the past 2 years, this has really been an issue here on the Cape with water contamination, especially in the Hyannis area, the Hyannis water supply, as well as areas around Joint Base Cape Cod, where these emerging chemicals of concern have been getting into the groundwater, into the water supply, and they're expected to be suspected to be from firefighting foams that have been used at the Barnstable Airport as well as on Joint Base Cape Cod.
These are the perfluorinated chemicals. Yes.
Right. So this week, an $8 million 5-year research program that is going to focus on perfluorinated chemicals in the Cape's water supply was launched. This $8 million project is funded by the National Institute of Environmental Health, and it is a collaboration between the University of Rhode Island, the T.H. Chan School of Public Health at Harvard University, as well as the Silent Spring Institute. And the focus is going to be on around Hyannis and Joint Base Cape Cod. Some of the activities that they'll be undertaking in this research program over the course of the next 5 years is testing private wells here on the Cape to determine the level of chemicals in them, study how these enter the groundwater. They can really learn a lot as to how this happened here on the Cape, and field test some new methodology to detect these chemicals. And also, let's talk about reducing exposure. That's a major thing they're going to be looking at, too. And of course, these chemicals are known to have some health effects on humans, including immune system issues, affecting pregnancy outcomes, liver disease, and endocrine disruption, and some metabolic changes. So a very important project underway here.
5-year project there.
5 years.
We're going to speak now with Andy Tomalonis at South Coast Today. Good morning, Andy.
Good morning, Steve.
Andy, in the fallout from the Codfather indictment, a big fishing sector out of New Bedford has been taken off the water. You have an interesting story about some of the impact this has on fishermen and what they're saying. Can you explain this a little bit for us? It's a bit complicated.
Sure. So I'll start with a little background. We all know about the Codfather. He's the New Bedford fishing magnate, Carlos Rafael. And he was sentenced this fall to 4 years in prison for his scheme of cheating the fishing regulations and selling his catch on the black market. So, I mean, that's important because his fishing, changing the numbers of his fish affected the way the entire sector runs itself and keeps track of its fish. So Carlos's own boats, a fish processing facility, numerous permits. They were all grouped into this sector, and that's a consortium of permit holders who are supposed to stay within allotted quotas and self-police, with some degree of checking from NOAA. So as a result of Carlos's misreporting, the group's information on fish that's been harvested has now been called into question, and NOAA wants the sector to provide a more accurate count of how many fish of what kinds have been taken. So last month, the regional administrator for NOAA, who's a former New Bedford mayor, ordered the boats back in. And so they're allowed to sell their fish that they brought in with them, but they can't go out anymore until NOAA is satisfied with the count. So that means, you know, about 20 boats with 80 fishermen or so are not able to provide for their families this season. And it's tough at Christmas. And furthermore, the city seafood businesses are also suffering. The support system, the ice, the processing, you know, all of that stuff. And the mayor has made that point known to NOAA. This week he traveled to Washington and presented his case to NOAA assistant administrator Chris Oliver. So also this week, there were a group of fishermen who protested at the regional meeting of the New England Fisheries Council, which was, I think it was Wednesday in Newport, Rhode Island. The owner of the New Bedford Seafood Auction joined the fishermen, and they were protesting the sanctions, and they described the personal toll that it's taking on the ground fishermen and their families. So, yeah, there's no presents under the Christmas tree, but it's just, you know, there's just not money to go around because they're out of business. One fisherman was out of work. He had an injury, so he was out for an extended time and had just returned to work, so he hasn't been able to collect unemployment. So there's a personal toll that's been taken, you know, on about 80 fishermen. And Mayor Mitchell, who's argued for a different kind of a settlement, has said that this was going to happen, that it would take a toll on innocent people, you know, the people who worked, you know, at the fishing level within Carlos's sector.
And the support services for those fishing boats,
yes,
20 fishing
sure.
boats. Yeah.
Yes, yes. So that's a lot. That's a lot of business that comes into New Bedford through the fishing industry. And you might know New Bedford scallops make up the bulk of the value of New Bedford's fishing crop, and the ground fishing is a portion of the pie, but not as big as scalloping. But New Bedford has been the number one fishing port in the nation for the last 15 years or so, and that's based on the value of its catch. So it beats all the other fishing ports in the country, Alaska and, you know, New England and the Gulf of Mexico.
Hmm. Andy Tomolonis of SouthCoastToday.com. Andy, thanks for joining us and updating us on this.
Thank you.
Jeff Spillane from Cape Cod Times with me here. And Jeff, the federal agency in charge of overseeing nuclear power plants made a proposed change to its oversight process, which has raised flags for a number of groups, particularly folks looking at Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station in Plymouth.
Yeah, it certainly did, Steve. This has really created quite a bit of outrage amongst the opponents of the nuclear power plant in Plymouth and those who want to close right away. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission right now is looking to make its engineering inspection program a bit more efficient. And a proposal was floated recently, and it did seem to have the endorsement of the Nuclear Energy Institute, that it would allow plant operators to self-assess or inspect their own operations, which, as you can
imagine, this is like self-policing. Yes,
like self-policing. And the folks behind this proposal are saying, well, you know, there's duplication of effort here because the operators of the nuclear power plants are already doing a lot of the preparation work, getting ready for the NRC inspections. So once again, as I can say, as you imagine, the outrage was swift, and there was a lot of it this week. And of course, Pilgrim being in Category 4, which means it's one of the three worst performers in the United States, there's a lot of concern here regarding this proposal. Congressman Keating said that he's going to reach out to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for additional information, but he said he is vehemently opposed to this.
And Pilgrim, of course, has a long history behind this of I think that the people who criticize the plant say that they whenever problems are identified, they don't move quickly to address them.
That's
and
right.
The idea of having them be self-policing is concerning.
Yeah, definitely. And of course, Pilgrim is set to close in May of 2019, so another year and a half.
Jeff, we heard a report this week about a county meeting on Wednesday night that got louder than expected. You were there to cover this. Tell us what this is about and what happened at this county meeting.
I was there. Chaos, pandemonium, bad behavior. I don't know what else I can say, Steve. It was at a meeting of the Barnesville County Assembly of Delegates, typically a very calm group of 15 members that represent each town on the Cape in county government, so the legislative body. But Brian O'Malley, the delegate from Provincetown had presented a resolution to the assembly, a resolution which really isn't an ordinance, which leads to a law. A resolution is just an opinion of the body, that he wanted the assembly of delegates to oppose Barnstable County Sheriff Jim Cummings' application to join the ICE 287G program. That application is, we're just waiting to hear right now whether or not it's been accepted or not. It would allow the sheriff's offices here in Barnstable County to access the ICE database to determine if prisoners, whether they're there on bail or without bail, should be detained if they're illegal immigrants, which would, you know, eventually lead to the deportation process. The Cape Cod Coalition for Safe Communities showed up at this meeting in force, really surprising the Speaker of the Assembly, who claimed that the meeting had been hijacked, that she wasn't aware that there was going to be such a large showing, and there were so many people that wanted to offer public comment, she limited it to a minute and a half because it was a very long meeting. And one thing led to another. It went downhill very quickly. Speakers were demanding more time. There were calls from the audience. So the speaker, Suzanne McAuliffe, just said, enough of this, was very, very upset, started banging the gavel, said, this meeting is adjourned, and she just stormed out of the room. Frankly, I've never seen anything like it.
Adjourned the meeting in the middle of the meeting.
She did. They later came back, it was very contentious. And the thing about all of this, which is somewhat ironic, is the Barnstable County Assembly of Delegates, nor any of the other branch, the Barnstable County Commissioners, the other branch of county government, they have no say in this matter at all. So any position the Assembly of Delegates would take on this would be symbolic. And I should say, there was no decision made on it. It has been continued to January 3rd. And at that meeting on January 3rd, this will be taken up again. And the sheriff will be there to address the audience. So get your tickets now.
Okay. Ann Wood is with us right now from the Provincetown Banner. Ann, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Hi, Jeff. How's it going?
Good morning, Ann.
And you have a fun story about some folks who are waiting for a bus, a very typical bus, and a different kind of bus showed up. Tell us about this.
Imagine waiting for the Plymouth and Brockton bus to pick you up in either Provincetown or Hyannis to bring you to the other place. And instead of the shiny big PMB bus with bathrooms and Wi-Fi, in comes a bus that kind of looks like it's from a Ken Kesey novel. It's the Funk Bus, which is owned and operated in Provincetown.
The Funk Bus.
It's a Funk Bus. These are multicolored buses that are usually used. They're rented for bachelorette parties or other people who want to hang out in town and drink or go to the Wellfleet Beachcomber for Provincetown back. And it's owned by Mercedes Cab Company. But because of a driver shortage at PNB, they have contracted with the Funk Bus to sometimes take people from Provincetown to Hyannis or Hyannis to Provincetown.
Yeah. And so folks got to ride in a different kind of bus.
So what happens is the bus pulls up. We have a picture of one in our paper this week. It's green with purple stripes and this wording that says Funk Bus on the side. And there's no merry band of pranksters inside. It's just sort of a, you know, regular driver who gets people aboard and takes them to Provincetown or to Hyannis. Now, the bus is not at all the same as the PMB bus. It's more like an old school bus that's been transformed into a fun, funky party bus. But there's, I guess, no partying going on in the bus. What happened, according to Chris Anzoni, and I hope I'm saying his name right, who's the vice president of Plymouth and Brockton Street Railway Companies, is they had a huge shortage of drivers this summer. Basically, when President Trump decided to kind of nix a lot of the visas so that foreign people to come in and work for the summer, that not only affected restaurants and shops here in Provincetown and the rest of the Cape, but also the PMB bus line. So instead of having people sit at a bus stop and wait for a bus that never came, it contracted with the Funk Bus, which would show up once in a while, which is still being used mostly on weekends, mostly on Sundays, to get people from Provincetown to Hyannis or the other way around. And about this time of year, twice a day, the Plymouth and Brockton makes the trip from Hyannis and Provincetown. In the summer, it's three times a day. So they're still seeing a driver shortage, which they said affected their trips to Boston more than Provincetown. But there's a lot of people that come to that travel between Provincetown and Hyannis on the P&B bus. Last year, they sold a little more than 17,000 tickets. Mm. So it was kind of a big deal. So people got a ride. Not a lot of them. Some of them weren't that excited to be on a funk bus instead of the cushy P&B bus, but they got to their destination. And it seems like an only in Provincetown story.
It does.
I mean, I can imagine sitting in Hyannis and waiting for the bus, and the funk bus pulls up.
It's kind of
the perfect introduction to P-Town.
Yes, to take you out to Provincetown. And you have another story that I want to touch on briefly, which is about the Truro Police Department allowing its officers to grow beards for a very specific reason.
Right. When's the last time you saw a police officer with a beard? Only in November and in Truro on the Outer Cape. Truro was one of 60 police departments across the state and the only one on the Outer Cape that participated in No Shave November, a first-of-its-kind program that allowed cops to grow beards last month to help raise awareness for and money for Home Base, the Red Sox Foundation and Mass General Hospital program that helps veterans and their families heal from post-traumatic stress disorder, traumatic brain injury, and other invisible wounds. Sergeant Jeremiah Valley, who was one of the people who grew his beard, kind of didn't want to shave it after. It turned into kind of a big red beard, he said, because he's Irish and Scandinavian. And he likened himself to an elf, but I'd like to say he looks more like a Viking. But they were sad when they had to shave it off. Most of the police departments that actually did this, police officers, got to go to Fenway Park on November 30th for a big shave-off because there's only 13 officers in Truro. They couldn't do that, but they all shaved them off December 1st. They got an extra day, so I'm sure Sergeant Valley was happy about that.
Nice story. And I want to mention that this is your last time joining us on the News Roundup. You're leaving the Provincetown Banner. I want to say thank you so much. It's been great having you as a guest.
Thanks. It was so fun to be on. I'll keep listening. Take care.
Very good. I'm Steve Junker. This is the News Roundup. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Jeff Spillane. We're going to go to the break now. When we come back, we're going to hear from George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. This is the News Roundup on The Point. Welcome back. We are discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Jeff Spillane, and on the phone with us right now is George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve, and good morning, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, George.
George, you have a story about a mother whose son died of an overdose, and now she's pressing for a manslaughter case against the dealer. The police say sold him the drugs. You have a lot of voices from family members here. It's a very strong story.
Yeah, so this is an interesting case because the district attorney's office did charge the alleged drug dealer, this is Aaron Bazaler, with distribution of drugs and conspiracy to violate the drug laws, and that trial is due to come up later this month. The mom, after hearing the evidence against him in that case and looking at some of the reports, saw that police had traced the fentanyl that he took back to this person, and she wondered why he wasn't being held responsible. So she did a little digging and found out that she could bring a criminal complaint herself. She filed that criminal complaint. It went through the process, which is going before a clerk magistrate who hears, well, actually he reviewed the evidence that was presented in documents. And in reviewing that, he decided that there was enough evidence there to bring a criminal complaint. So Aaron Bazaler is going to be arraigned on a charge of manslaughter 4 days before he goes to trial on those other drug-related charges. I should say that the mom involved here is Brenda Williston Floyd. And at first she was a little bit reluctant to speak out about this, but then decided that it was really important as a parent that she speak out about this. She doesn't want this to happen to other people's children. And she really wants to fight for justice for her son.
What's the feeling on the island? I saw some comments on there that were quite strong too.
Yeah, so you know, the Sylvia family is a long-standing family on the island, and there were a ton of people at his funeral. People are very emotional about this, and they're standing behind this mom. They're saying that, you know, drug dealers do have to be held responsible. You know, in this particular case, I took a really close look at the court records in this case, and there's a detailed text exchange between her son and Aaron Bezalel, and in that text exchange, he thinks he's getting heroin. He doesn't think he's getting heroin laced with fentanyl. He thinks he's getting heroin, you know, and so he took a dose that he thought was safe, you know, according to his mother, and, you know, it ended up killing him because fentanyl is a much stronger drug, as we've all come to find out, than heroin. And, you know, it's a really sad story that he's the father of a child. He's a brother. He's a son. Well-liked person, you know, played hockey, a plumber on the island. And so, you know, it's really affected people, as this whole opioid crisis has. And so it's going to be interesting to see how this moves forward, given that the DA's office took a pass the first time. Are they now willing to take up this case and prosecute it on behalf of this mother?
George, I want to switch gears here for a moment, and before we let you go, ask you about Edgar Town's Christmas festivities, which must be ramped up.
Yeah, so this is this weekend, and if you get a chance to get over there, there's a lot happening. We have all those on our website, and we have a special section in our paper that was done by one of our folks, Brittany Boker, and she did a tremendous job pulling together not just what's happening in Edgartown, but what's happening all across the island. But Edgartown, this is a big weekend for them. I took a cruise through there last night. It looks beautiful. It's ready for folks to get over there and enjoy all the different concerts and venues that are having special events this coming weekend. And my understanding is that you can take a Highline boat from Hyannis as well as the Steamship Authority.
George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for all of that. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah. Thank you. Have a good weekend.
I'm with Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times. And Jeff, let me give me a moment to shuffle my papers. Oh, so you had a story this week, an interesting story about rehab facilities that have been sort of ignoring a law that's been on the books, and a mother who's really pushing to get them to pay attention to this law.
That's right, Steve. This is very, very, very interesting. Casey Myers, who has been who covers the opioid crisis for us, wrote this article. There was a general understanding amongst the community that for someone to be placed in a rehabilitation facility for drug or alcohol abuse, you actually had to be on drugs or have alcohol in your system.
You had to test positive.
You had to test positive for that. But it turns out that's not the case. In Massachusetts, a state policy in 2008 called No Wrong Door says that nobody who's seeking substance abuse treatment can be turned away. A lot of people didn't know that, and the law wasn't being enforced. So a woman from Kootenai, her name is Christine Kelly, talked a little bit about that to us this week. She said before she sought some treatment for her son, she gave him two martinis, so it didn't test possible for alcohol. And once she found out about this policy, No Wrong Door, she said, yeah, we got to do something about this so people know about it and the providers know about it too. So she got on change.org, got almost 3,200 signatures to get the state to enforce the law. Now, 2 weeks ago, it seems those efforts have paid off. The Bureau of Substance Abuse here in Massachusetts sent a letter telling all state licensed and contracted providers to post this in their office, a Know Your Rights type document. Mm-hmm. And not only that, It covers people who are on medications provided by physicians, as well as those who have been in the past left facilities against the advice of their professionals who have been treating them, and those who have filed grievances before. Apparently, this was not known, and there were many reasons that were being used that you couldn't get into a rehab.
Hmm. Jeff, I want to talk about a story about a number of groups who came together to protest a proposed expansion of the Canal Energy Generating Plant in Sandwich this past weekend. Sounds like it was quite a spirited gathering.
It was. They sang songs. They had, as our reporter Tanner Sending said, a little theatrical skit that went with it. This is an expansion of the NRG Energy's Canal Generator Plant in Sandwich. And it was organized by the Conservation Law Foundation, the Sierra Club of Massachusetts, and what's a group called 350 Mask of Cape Cod. What the protesters are saying is that this will increase additional use of fossil fuels, which, of course, we're trying to get away from, and violate the state's climate change policies. And the Conservation Law Foundation is saying that the Massachusetts Energy Facilities Siting Board, they didn't take the Global Warming Solutions Act here in the state into consideration, so they filed an appeal of this. Massachusetts, of course, has set a goal of reducing greenhouse gas emissions by the year 2020 to 25%. That's a maximum 25% of 1990 levels. So these folks are saying they've done some research, and this NRG Canal plant, their carbon footprint would be 25% of all energy-related emissions produced on the Cape and Islands as a whole. So this should be this appeal has been filed with the Supreme Judicial Court in Boston.
That said, it has the potential to bring a lot of money to
$50 million over the course of 20 years for Sandwich. So the town manager is saying, hey, if you're thinking about economic development here, this is our chance. So, yeah, of course, money is playing a role in this.
And Tanner's article points out that the protest this weekend kind of educated a number of people in Sandwich who didn't even know this was happening.
They didn't even know it happened. I guess it was approved at town meeting. And, yeah, we know.
I mean, we've reported on, but yeah.
Isn't well attended in most towns. I'm not sure what the rate was in Sandwich. I know my town sometimes is around 2%. So people who live in Sandwich came upon the protest and had no idea this had happened.
Hmm. The Massachusetts Medical Society has gone on record opposing assisted suicide for terminally ill patients, but a new survey of its members suggests that that feeling could be changing.
It does, and tomorrow's a big day for the Massachusetts Medical Society. But a recent survey of doctors who belong to the society, 60% of doctors who responded to a survey believe that doctors should be able to help terminally ill patients end their lives. The response rate, however, for this was only about 12% when they sent out the survey, but that still is almost 3,000 doctors. Now, tomorrow, the governor's board, the governing board of the Mass Medical Society, which was referred to as the House of Delegates, they're going to meet tomorrow in Boston to take these, they're going to take these results into consideration and take a vote whether to reverse its previous stance. So we'll know more tomorrow. There's a local angle here. Dr. Roger Kleigler of Falmouth has been championing this cause. He's filed a lawsuit along with Dr. Alan Steinbach from here in Woods Hole against District Attorney Michael O'Keefe and Attorney General Maura Healey to have assisted suicide here in the state. And there's also a bill before the legislature right now that we expect to come out of committee in February. And Senator Julian Sear from the Cape and Islands is one of the sponsors.
One of the sponsors so, there.
Yeah, and there's some of the doctors, and it's just, this is an interesting thing that I never thought of. And when I saw this, I'm like, this makes sense. Some of the doctors who responded to the survey said there is a little bit of concern here because if we allow this assisted suicide, or allowing doctors to help patients end their lives, could there be some financial situations really lead some low-income and elderly folks to pressure them into doing this? So,
but there are models for this kind of this kind of policy that would one that are in effect in other states. Other states have this already, so I'm sure they're looking at.
I believe the six states
where this has worked elsewhere and how they're doing it.
That's right.
Last week, we heard about Nantucket adding massive battery storage on the island to stabilize its backup power. Uh-huh. You have an article out today in the paper about a plan to add two more such stations in the region, one on the Outer Cape and one on Martha's Vineyard. This is really some front-edge technology.
It certainly is, and this is news that came out of the governor's office yesterday. Massachusetts has a goal of creating 200 megawatts of energy storage by the year 2020. And yesterday, the administration announced $20 million in grants to help reach this, as well as approval of some projects that have already been proposed. And the Cape and Islands are some big beneficiaries of this announcement yesterday. Eversource received the okay to build a 5-megawatt energy storage facility on the Vineyard, as well as a 12-megawatt facility on the Outer Cape. Not a lot of details as to where these will be located, when they'll be up and running. They're right in the engineering planning stage right now. But in the long run, these are going to prevent the need for additional wire projects, such as cables going from the Cape to the Vineyard, and will allow more reliability. Mm-hmm. To the island should something happen to the cables. Some of the other grants that came through yesterday was the Martha's Vineyard Regional Transit Authority.
I thought this was fascinating.
Yeah, it is.
So they're
looking
to electrify the bus system.
They're going to electrify the entire fleet. They received $545,000 for lithium-ion batteries, a storage facility that's going to allow the entire fleet to be electrified.
Paired with solar power.
Solar powered and electrified, right. And there was also a grant that is going to provide 500 residential batteries to homes on Nantucket as well. So, big day for the Cape and Islands.
I want to skip ahead to a story that Cindy McCormick, nice article by Cindy McCormick on the ways that some school districts are looking to supplement funding while supporting teachers and programs. Sounds like it's a bit of an end run around the school funding model.
It is. With budgets being so tight right now in public education, many organizations on the Cape have been formed to raise private funds for public schools, the most recent being the Bourne Education Foundation, which was recently established. These groups in towns are trying to help fund innovative projects, programs, and activities that don't fit into the traditional school budgets, yet they are projects that some of the teachers really want to undertake. So Bourne is going to start giving out some mini grants next month. They've already collected $3,000 and allow some of the teachers to take their ideas and run with them. And this concept is already up and running in Sandwich, Barnstable, Denison, Yarmouth, Falmouth, and the Nauset Regional School District. And they projects range from bringing in authors of books to speak with the students to trips. I know Falmouth took some students out to Penicuese and Cuttyhunk for an art project.
So allowing some more creative programs to continue to go forward.
Exactly.
And we have a proposed Vietnam War Memorial in Sandwich moving forward after getting some funding from the Community Preservation Committee.
They did, yeah. Former President Barack Obama had declared the years 2012 to 2025 as the 50th anniversary of the Vietnam War, and to commemorate it here in the country. So the Sandwich Community Preservation Committee did allocate $15,000 for construction of a Vietnam War memorial in a park next to Town Hall in Sandwich. It's going to be a polished gray and black monument made of granite to remember the Sandwich residents who fought in the war.
And that will be the first memorial on the Cape for the Vietnam War.
It will.
That's our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guests, Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle, Andy Tomalonis of South Coast Today, and we heard from Ann Wood at the Provincetown Banner and George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. I want to thank Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times for joining us. And thank you for listening. I'm Steve Junker.